feels like a very long time. The last time we learned Megillas Rus was 3 weeks ago. Last week was Purim, the week before we missed, and this week we're back on track. So just to recap one particular point, which we didn't cover, which is a little bit of a hangover from last time, is Orpah, who's sort of in the dark recesses of history, is as we focused on in terms of we focused on Rus and Rus's journey and the journey that Rus needed to take in order to be able to overcome the reasons that she would not want necessarily to make the decision to stay with her mother-in-law. But Orpah accepts the offer. Orpah is the one who, in the end of the day, accepts the offer and goes back home. So, how are we supposed to view Orpah? Just a thought out there. Do we view Orpah as the individual, as the bystander syndrome? As the bystander syndrome, the person who is on the sidelines of history, reactive but not proactive? That's one way of looking at her. But unfortunately, in today's day and age, it's a common human condition to be able to be somebody who stands and watches things, but doesn't necessarily become part of it. So one way of looking at Rus, which many argue, looking at Orpah, is she's the unfortunate carry who disappears. She's the character who disappears into the background, the tapestry of history, without necessarily making that difference that she could have or should have. Right? She had the offer, she returned the kiss, and she went back home. But it may be a little more than that. It may be a little more than that. Just one second, let me just to take it to the next level. It may be, in fact, be that or it's there's something more going on. Because there's a midrash which some of you are familiar with. I think Esther mentioned it a few weeks ago. Is that the midrash says now, whether it's to be taken literally or not literally, but that it says that Orpah on the way back was raped by 100 people on the way back. Now, I don't know if that means to say that that is to be taken as a literal thing, and it says that there was a dog at the end as well, which is just, unfortunately, it's a very hard midrash to understand. But what is the continuation of that midrash is that her children became the ancestors or the patriarchs of Goliath, the giant Goliath. Now, whatever the midrash is driving at, it sounds like there's more than simply Orpah just disappearing out of the picture. It sounds like not she actually reappears in the picture, but not just as neutral, but as negative. That's the picture this midrash is drawing. That Orpah somehow, by stepping out, has not just stepped out into the neutral, but somehow there's something very negative about this. Now, this in general is just a concept which is important to appreciate, is that sometimes good and evil are very closely related or intermingled. So close sometimes that one little step separates the two into very, very different roads. It's interesting to see that in the end of the day, and this Esther again pointed out, is that you're going to have Goliath, who's the giant representing the Philistines in a few generations' time, cursing Elohim Chaim, cursing the living God of the Jews, and David HaMelech, who's the grandson of Rus, the re-meeting of these two sisters, of these two people, in that final plot in the end, where Orpah doesn't just simply disappear, but Orpah took a route whereby that potential where she could have joined, that potential of becoming part of the dynasty, somehow went to a very negative potential. That potential went not just neutral, but awry. Leah, what were your thoughts? Correct. Correct.
Even the classic example is against David HaMelech. But also when you said about Orpah disappearing from the scene, I think it's somewhat like Esther. The person is given potential, and it's what they do or don't.
Correct. So coming back to last week's discussion, actually that's very important in terms of taking your place in history. But that would be viewing it in a more of a sad missing the action. But it may be a little more than that. That's just worthwhile thinking about, because what this midrash seems to be arguing is that somehow Orpah does have a role in history. She doesn't just disappear. She has a role in history, but it's a negative role in history. Oh, so there might be a tradition. In general, one has to ask the question, is the Midrash coming from a specific diok in the Psukim? Is it coming from a tradition that accompanied with it? Not clear.
Are there any her name, that she turned her back.
Right, so yes, you're right. So I mean, Orif literally means, as you said, the back of the neck, which is used by where Yehuda, interestingly enough, where it talks about Yehuda, it says, Yadecha va'orif oivechot, your hand is chasing the back of the fleeing enemy, which is where it's used as in one place. So it does have significance in that sense, but again, it's hard to know if the names, there's a debate in the Mefarshim, the Mamno Eis has many different options in terms of whether Rus and Orpah's names were their converted names or their original names or significant, so it's hard to know on that point. But anyway, there's something in that Midrash which is suggesting more than just simply neutrality or disappearing, but more that there's actually a role to be played in history, and when you choose the wrong path, actually the wrong path takes you in a very different direction. That's just a footnote from last time as a consideration. We're not going to do Orpah full justice, but that's something just worthwhile, I think necessary to be mentioned as we move on. What today's topic is the last five psukim, or last four psukim actually, of Perek Aleph, and we'd like to focus on this week and more on the parshanot, the understanding what's going on over here in the conversation, and then finally, and next week hopefully to start with the discussion, the comparison of Naomi and Eov, which should be in the back of our minds as we cover these psukim. It's a very short span of psukim, but there's a lot of things going on in them. So let's just first, I'd like to just read them all four together and then subdivide and conquer. So starting, this is on page, I do not have the source book in front of me. This is page 3. So as you can see, it's under the line, right? We're in the next section now. So this is in Pasuk Yud Tes. Vateilachna shtehem. Both of them walked ad bo'ana beis lachem, until they arrived at beis lechem. Vahika bo'ana beis lechem, as they arrived at beis lechem, vatehom kol ha'ir aleihem, vatomana hazos nami. The whole city is gathering around, the whole city is amazed, and they ask, is this Naomi? Vatomer aleihem, al tikrena li Naomi. Don't call me Naomi, karenali mara, call me bitter. Ki heimar shakai li ma'od, because God embittered my life very much. Ani melea halachti, I walked, or I left, full verekom hashivani Hashem, and I was returned empty. Lomo sikreno li Naomi, why do you call me Naomi, which means pleasant in this context, v'Hashem onovi Hashem, responded literally to me, or testified against me, v'shakai ha'irali, and God was evil to me. V'atoshav Naomi v'rus ha'movia kalosa imo, and they return, Rus and her, and daughter-in-law, Hashava Mistei Moav, who's returning from the fields of Moav, Vehema Ba'u Beis Lechem B'tchilas Ketzir Sa'arim. And they returned to Beis Lechem, to Bethlehem, at the beginning of the barley harvest. So there's a lot going on in these psukim. This is the first time that they actually come back. But let's try to analyze each little piece by itself. There's a lot going on in these very few psukim. So the first thing to note is that when we know how big this group is, we know that there are how many people in this group? There are two people in this group. So therefore, when the pasuk tells us "Vatailachda shehem," shehem is an unnecessary word, right? We don't need to know that there are two of them. By simple math, we know that Orpah is left, Rus and Naomi are left. So that's it. So shehem, what was that? That is a good question. The question that Debbie raised is that shehem is male, is actually not a female word, and it's referring to, what was that? Shtehen. Oh, I apologize. Good point. Thank you. Absolutely. There we go. For all the Hebrew teachers in the room, an important lesson, right? The nun. Shnei is two, shtei is two for female. The expectation would have been shtehen. That's that. The question is the nun at the end, which is being questioned. That is a good question. There is discussion among the Farshim. I'm just going to throw this out.
So everything else is in the Sheva.
Correct. Everything else is with the Nun at the end. There is discussion in the Mamlo'ez, who suggests from a particular Pirush, I don't remember the specific name, that they actually, they walked back dressed up actually as males, which is interesting. I don't know if this is based on this diok, but there might be something over there.
That's to protect themselves.
Now, it is interesting, bringing back the Midrash of Orpah, one can maybe assume that it was not safe to be walking as ladies alone. I don't know if this is the particular tikkun that's coming off, but as you point out, then it's a bit of a half-half word. On the one end, shtei, which is female, and ending with hem, which is male, it might indicate some form of disguise. Be it as it may, and that's a good question, which I have not seen addressed specifically. But let's for a moment remove ourselves from the tense of it, but it is an unnecessary word, meaning we know how many there are. Why are we being told that both of them are going together? Because there's a statement of? Right, so this means to say, the reminder is Avraham and Yitzhak, where they have the same intent. Right, so this could mean in terms of intent of Rus and Naomi, that they have their ideals aligned. But even more, it could be maybe actually a statement from above them, which is, in a certain sense, not how they view the world together, but rather how Hashem views them, which is a very fascinating point. Vatelachna shtehem means to say that we just have over here a person who's just converted to Judaism. And you have two individuals who've led very different lives up to this point, but what happens? The Pasuk is saying, Vatelachna shtehem, that they're seen in the same group. They're seen that they're walking along the same path. So this is a statement in terms of, this is a statement of endearment towards Ruth specifically in terms of the equation with her mother-in-law, Naomi, as you see these two people walking together. That's point number one. The Yalkut Shimoni points out that when it says, when these people respond in the first pasuk, Hazos Naomi, is this Naomi? The Yalkut Shimoni points out the incredible wealth and the incredible kindness that Naomi had previously exemplified in the city. That Naomi had, the Midrash goes to say that she made gold pale, meaning she was so beautiful. She had so many people that she had silk clothes, and now she had rags. And the Midrash builds up all these parallels in terms of assets, but also in terms of the kindness. This is the person who everybody could turn to, and now she's walking in destitute. So the Midrash draws this immense picture of the contrast of what she was and what they see her as now. But it's more than that. It's more than that. If you can imagine, for me, this is why I was a little late, is I was trying to find the book itself, that for those of you who are familiar with the earlier Harlem Renaissance or Enlightenment movement, there was a writer, Zora Neale Hurston, who wrote a number of books, and she had a book called And Their Eyes Were Watching God. It's a very beautiful read. Don't see any enlightened eyes. But the beginning of the book is there's a particular scene where the main character, a lady, is returning to her city, returning to her town, a black lady, and she has really seized the moment. She went out and explored life, and she's coming back alone. And the scene describes, as you hear all the neighbors, and they're all whispering on their balconies and on their front porches, and everybody's talking and suggesting maybe what could have happened and why is she alone and what must have happened over these years. And there's a buzz as she walks through the main street of the town. And it gives you the sense of what you can imagine is happening over here. For me, that was a very telling scene. In these very few psukim, you don't hear so much about it, but you can imagine what's going on over here. Naomi is walking in. And imagine the emotions on both sides. Rav Yeshua Bachrach points out, let's think about this. She's the lady who walked out when everybody needed her. She was the lady who was the person who could have stabilized the economy somewhat with their wealth, and she walked out. Ostensibly, she could have ended up being the curse word of the town for the years afterwards. You should be like Naomi, who left us in the lurch. But at the same time, how can they be angry at this person who's walking in with nothing? And in this tension of emotions, what the word that comes out is Hazos Naomi. There's so much surprise. The disproportion of what was and what is so great that all they can say in amazement is Hazos Naomi. Is this really Naomi? Ruth, what are your thoughts? Okay, correct. So the anger was in terms of what they may have felt initially. And how that translates to now is perhaps how, what's their policy going to be, which we have to see, right? So how are they going to respond? Because now it's the wheel of fortune has switched almost diametrically opposite, right? She is the one who's in need. They're the ones who are now harvesting, right? So it becomes, and that becomes the question, that's the silent question beneath the scenes over here. Yeah, so we had seen this before. We had noticed this before. And this is we mentioned, that the Malbim already mentioned that it says that that Elimelech was, sorry, I apologize, Naomi was called Ish. Elimelech was called Ish Naomi, the husband of Naomi. And the Midrash, followed by a number of the Mephoreshim, had said that in this case, he made the decision. And she was not keen on this. So when she actually walked out, she was the one who was unfortunately proven right, meaning she said this is not the right move. He ended up doing the wrong thing. He suffered, but she ended up carrying the bags. Right. So with that in mind, it's a very difficult scene over here in this because this blame may be misplaced somewhat. There might be a misplaced blame over here, which makes it even worse, unfortunately. But one should just be aware of the fanfare of what's occurring as they walked into town. Intriguingly, Rashi actually quotes a midrash on this very pasuk that it wasn't just that the people were suddenly flocked to the center of town as she walks in. There was already a gathering. There was already something going on in town that was already bringing out everybody from the town, and this diverted attention. And as Leah mentioned, there is the funeral of the wife of Boaz. Now we don't see this in the text, but Rashi is quoting a midrash that this day was the funeral of the wife of Boaz. The funeral of the wife of Boaz, and that's interesting because as readers, as the omniscient reader, and we can see the whole scene, we have this dramatic irony. We're able to sense how as Boaz's wife slips out of the scene, the future wife, Ruth, is slipping into the scene, and also not just the future wife, but also the possibility of this entire story working is occurring at this time. So that's an interesting addition, which adds a little bit of contrast to this story as they walk into town on this day.
Did she have a name?
Who?
The wife.
No, not for not for our knowledge. It's the question, no, because it's interesting, because it is interesting who Boaz really is, which we will get to, whether he was one of the Shoftim that we know, or he was another person. But we're told that he had many children, but we don't know specifically their names or his wife's names. In terms of the Doros, because remember, as the Nevi'im and the Ksuvim that we have are a specific selection of the things which are necessary for us today. They were canonized, specifically those. So certain details which are not as necessarily relevant for the Ladoros aren't necessarily there. So that might be part of that. But yes, his whole family. He had a huge family. We don't know too much about them as a whole. So now, that's pasuk number one. She walks into town. Everybody's talking. So what happens? Naomi says the following. She says, just focusing now on pasuk Chof and Chof Aleph. And again, just to read the psukim, Vatomer Alehen Al Tikrena Li Naomi. She says, "Don't call me Naomi. Karena Li Mara. Call me embittered. Ki Hemar Shakai Li Meod. Because God was made me very bitter. Ani Melea Halakti Verekama Shivani Hashem. I went full. I returned empty. Hashem returned me empty. Lama Tikrena Li Naomi. Why do you call me Naomi? Vashem Onavi Veshakai Harali." God was Onabi. What the hell? You translate the word honor now in analyzing specifically. Honor literally means. So most commonly it means answered. Not necessarily. If we go back for 50 weeks till our last Shira on Pesach, when you talk about Lechem Oni, Oni could also mean articulating or making clear. For instance, when you talk about Lechem Oni, the matzah is lechem she'onim la'olav dvarim harbe. It doesn't mean you're answering the matzah. It means to say you are articulating specific matters over the matzah. Right? When you say va'anisa va'marta arami oved avi, it doesn't mean to say you are answering the kohen when you do the bikurim ceremony. It means to say you're articulating over the bikurim. That's one another explanation of it. And so it could mean that Hashem made very clear Hashem will be made very clear. What could he have made clear in this case? What is she saying that Hashem made clear? In a certain sense, or she, or the, let's put the family unit here, just to step away from Timna's point, is that the family unit was proven wrong for their actions. And now, more than that, it could also mean there's another use of the word ana in Aser Sadebros, which is?
Testify,
right? Don't bear false testimony on your friend. So not only is Hashem articulating, making clear, Hashem is testifying. In a certain sense, she is the testimony of what action, or she is the remains of what actions of, as we discussed in the second share, of what it means to say to leaving people behind when they're in a time of need. Very, very heavy statement she's making over here. Leah, what do you think? Yes, that's Inui. That actually comes from a different root, although I'm sure there's a relationship. But Inui is actually suffering in that case, affliction. It would be interesting to look into that. The person it's a different Shoresh, but it would be interesting to look into Rav Hirsch. He doesn't have it, but what people did was they took a dictionary and they made an etymological dictionary of Rav Hirsch, because Rav Hirsch often makes a lot of connections, which are intriguing. Between specific words, I'd be interested to see if that's connected. But in terms of Anna, there's a number of possibilities, and some of them are coming out in her either articulation or in testifying, which is what the Mefarshim bring up. Rashi suggests it's actually testimony. What does it mean when she says that I was full and I returned empty? Full of what? Empty of what? What? So what? Right. So most basically, we have wealth and we have children. We have wealth and children, and perhaps even honor, which is a little more intangible. Leah's mentioning pregnant. There is a Dea which is mentioned in the Medrash, but without even needing to go there, just what she had. Very simple. She's coming back empty, which is now the opposite situation of what of how the townsfolk is. What is possible? What is? Sorry, what was this? Oh yeah, so the Ibn Ezra discusses how, in this case, he says sometimes the Aleph and the Hay are interchangeable, and Mara in this case really means with the Hay, but it's with an Aleph. So the Mefarshap Shat deal with that is an important point. It's the Aleph is not, it's not usually meant to spell to the Hay, but the Mefarshim deal with that point. The question one would have to think about is, in Pasuk Chof to Chof Aleph, one notices that she repeats herself. Right? She repeats herself. She says, "Don't call me Naomi." And she's in a very similar formulation. If you want to just parallel it, she uses the name Yudke Vovke, the Shem Avaya of Hashem, and the name Shakai of Hashem. Right? So she uses both of them in both psukim and repeats saying that you shouldn't call me Naomi. Right? In these two psukim. Why is she repeating herself? What is she trying to point out? Are there separate messages going on over here? So, the Malbim suggests that the first thing she needs to clarify over here is that her plight is objective and not relative. Because you can imagine she's walking into the town and people see her by herself. She's looking disheveled. She's with a strange girl. Right? That's the scene that people know. But they're questioning, is this Naomi? What really occurred to her? Does she have a Swiss bank account? What meaning? Is there something else over here? They don't know the full story. Naomi first clarifies that this situation that I'm in, says the and the Bible points out, is not a relative situation. It's not like I am less rich than I was before, but in relationship to the rest of you, I'm doing quite well. I'm doing objectively bad. Right? The marshal he gives is that, let's say a person loses a lot of money, but they still have a sizable amount. Relatively, they're poor. But objectively, in relationship, this is also relative, but objectively, they still have means. She's clarifying number one. In Pasuk Chof, God really, he took everything away. There's nothing left. It's not like there's something else which you're not seeing in the picture of here. Clarification number one. But then, there's a second clarification, and this is a little darker, unfortunately. This is something very sad to think about that Naomi is saying. Is who really is worse off? Who's worse off? A person who spent their entire life destitute, who never really made it to be able to put two quarters together, or a person who had it, had everything, and is now and is now on the streets, Chas v'Shalom. The second person is in a much worse situation. First of all, just in terms of the expectations and the style of life in which they lived beforehand, but also in terms of just the expectations, not just the style of life, the expectations of what they think they could have been or should be. There's an immense amount of regret. So now think about Naomi's situation. Naomi had everything. She was it. And now she's coming back. And what she's saying over here, the Malbim suggests that in the second pasuk, she's saying something much more than she was even mentioning about her present situation. She looks back on her years of wealth and her years of meleah, of fullness. And she says, that only made me worse off now. It only made me worse off now. She feels embittered not only by the down, but she feels embittered by the high. Do you see that? She's poisoned by the very high, which makes it worse now. It's a very, very sad statement which Naomi is making, as he sees in the words, Ani mele'a halachti v'rekom ashivenu. She's not talking about just the present situation. She's looking back on her wealth. She's looking back at the times where things were good, and she says, and she views that in a bitter state. This is a very scary thing to address, and it's as if it has poisoned her all the way through, because as we're familiar, just going back to poetry, in the words of Alfred Lord Tennyson, 'tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. Right, in memoriam. In Memoriam, 1850, one of the greatest poems of the 19th century, written about a friend of his who'd passed away, and he writes a poem in Memoriam about them. And that's a truth, that's a truism in life, in general, is appreciating the moment. But you can see how hard it is for Naomi. Naomi's in a place over here where she experienced a good life, but it's poisoning her view. Her current state is poisoning backwards.
It's just the opposite of what you said.
Absolutely. That's what I'm pointing out. That we know as a truth, that as we experience life, and all we are expected is that every day is its own blessing, every day is its own challenge. We do view things independently. We don't let things poison backwards. Naomi is in such a state of bitterness, as the Malbim is pointing out over here, that it does. It clouds her retrospective perspective. But without such a heavy emphasis, one could also point out that if you notice in these psukim, the word shav, the root shav appears how many times? The word shav, starting from your test, right? So we see it a few times, right? In pasuk chav aleph, she says heshivani Hashem, right? We see again in pasuk. Rav Atashav, in Kalasah Hashava Mistei Moav. There's a lot of Shav, which leads some of the later Mephoshim quoted in the Mamlo Eis to suggest that in fact over here what's going on is a process of Tshuva. Why is she talking about this? Why is this her first reaction to people? Is because there in the back of her mind is this guilt. There in the back of her mind is this guilt about how they left them. So what's the first thing she does? Is she tells them what she feels about it. She says, you know what, I was wrong. We were wrong. And in fact, this is the Rambam mentions in Hilchos Tshuva. I'm quoting from the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva in Perek Beis, in Halacha Hay. He says, V'shevach God al Lashav. It is a great praise, it's very praiseworthy, and hence very difficult. It's very praiseworthy. She is vade, for a person returning in Tshuva, she is vade barabim, that they should express publicly, or confess publicly v'yivadab sha'av lohem, and tell them their sins, v'magale averos shebeinon lebein chaveru la'acherim, and to tell that the sins that they committed between their friends, v'omer lohem, om am chatasi leploni, I sinned to so-and-so, v'asisi lo kach v'kach, v'areni hayom sha'av l'misnachem. I feel bad about it, I'm returning. And he talks about somebody who's arrogant, is the opposite of this. But this is only true about something which actually affects them. This is just to clarify, this does not mean to say that if a person's got something they need to fix with Hashem that they need to tell everybody else. That's not the appropriate place. But when it's something which affected everybody else, the appropriate thing to do, which is a very difficult thing, is to publicly admit, which is perhaps one of the hardest things for any person or public figure, and certainly of higher up public figure, to ever be able to do. So it's interesting that the Pesukim are couching these words of Shav, perhaps, as the context for the statement. Why is she saying these things? Option number one is, maybe it's a form of appeasing, maybe it's a form of tshuva for what she had, for what the last time these people had met. But moreover, maybe another reason she's mentioning this is what's called tzedakah din. Tzedakah din over here is a concept of accepting that which Hashem does. Because notice that in the very short span of two psukim in which she bemoans or she describes her state, she mentions Hashem's name how many times? Four times, right? Just in these two psukim, right? She mentions Hashem's name Yudke Vavke twice and Shakai twice. So everything that goes on, she doesn't leave it to the randomness of history. She says, you know what? Even though this was very difficult for me, where was it coming from? It was coming from Hashem. So there's an element of depression in here, or not in the clinical sense, but in terms of the way she looks back at these events. But there's also an element of tzedakah din, of realizing, justifying what had occurred, which is a very important statement to be made on many levels. There's tshuva, tzedakah din, all going on at the same time within these two statements of Naomi. And now, the question, coming back to what Ruth mentioned, the question that's really on the table over here is, what's the reaction? What's the reaction? Right? How are people going to respond to this if we view it in terms of at least a line of tshuva? If we view it in terms of relating to what had occurred those years back, at least 10 years prior, what is the reaction that she has, the reception she has afterwards? Everybody asked, what's the continuation going to be? We don't know. We're only told, this is a sad thing over here, is in Pasuk Kof Beis, Vatoshav Naomi v'ros Moav Yakalos Lo'imo Hashav v'Mistei Moav. They return. And her daughter-in-law returns from the Mistei Moav. V'heima bo'u beis lechem b'tchilas k'tzir so'orim. We don't hear anything more from those townspeople. Where are they? What do they do? Why are they alone? Right, we left. Well, nothing, right. Nothing has been said about these people. So what Tim was suggesting is there's an acceptance. Leah, what were your thoughts?
Well, because we know the end of the story, we know that at the end of the villa, what he told me is the final, when the women and the children came to the house like Rachel and Leah. So ultimately there is acceptance.
Absolutely, ultimately. But right now, but that's after Boaz intercedes, and Boaz certainly meets pressure, tension against the suggestion even. But you, at this point in time, there is an ominous silence. They ask the question, but there's nothing. There's no response. There's no follow up. It could be they're just simply busy, because what
they're stunned. Speechless.
They're stunned, but it seems like, as we're going to see in the beginning of the next parak, that what's the beginning of the next parak, as we're about to start, is Ezra now goes out to the field to collect. Why is she collecting? Have people not given her? Right? There's a very sad silence over here. In fact, what we should start with asking is, why is it important to mention the seasons here, besides for the global season theme in Rus? Ibn Ezra suggests that this is the context of why Rus is going to be collecting. But it might be more than that. It might be more than that over here. Is the Malbim points out that really they had property. They had a field which was now fallow and they left behind. Naomi now has to reclaim it. But think about this. Naomi now is reclaiming this field at the time that everybody else is harvesting. They've come now at the time when it's too late to do anything about it. It's too late to do anything about planting, and they're sitting there at this time, maybe with some land which they need to reclaim, which they can't necessarily redeem right now, as everybody else is harvesting. That's what she's seeing going on through the window.
But why can't she redeem it? It's her land, because she didn't plant it?
I don't, at that particular question, I'm not sure what the status is of this land without Boaz redeeming it is at this point in time. I'm not sure. I imagine that even if necessary, she had all the rights to it, but they can't do anything about it. It's just the wrong season. That's part of the
because
sad.
Someone else planted on her land?
No. There's nobody growing. There's nothing growing. Nothing growing. They're looking out the window. Everybody else is harvesting. They have a fallow, empty land. They have to wait for the next cycle.
Oh, because no one planted
on her. Exactly, because it's been left. Right. It could be that she has to reclaim it. It could be that squatters. We don't know. But that's part of this, the setting of the scene. And moreover, is think about this. She's left in the middle of town. She's explained the situation. And who's standing next to her? Rus, right? Rus was not part of this conversation. Rus wasn't discussed. Naomi doesn't even explain her. And you have to wonder, and this is what Yehoshua Bachrach points out, you have to wonder if perhaps the silence is in response to her as well. After all, when they hear the bar stories and they hear the rumors going around and they hear that Rus has left town and her husband had died and the two children got married to Moabites. Wait a second, we know that you're not allowed to marry Moabites. Remember, the halacha is coalescing right at this very point. So they take a step backwards. Wait a second, do we want to associate with this person? And there's this character Rus, and think about it from Rus's perspective. Rus realizes that something's not right. Right? And maybe it's me. Maybe part of it's me. But she just made this commitment to leave her entire life and a luxury to come somewhere else, to a place to become part of something, and that something doesn't want to accept you. Do you see what's going on over here? That's why that statement of Atelachna Shnehem, that they both went together, is very important. The Megillah is affirming that they're of equal stature. The people aren't necessarily seeing it that way, which is the sadness of this initial interaction. And moreover, if you want to parallel it backwards, remember that when they left Moab, the state of Moab, we are told two verbs. They left and they went. They left and they went. And Rashi had pointed out that why does it emphasize leaving? It emphasized leaving because they left an impression. They were people of note. They were people who really made a difference in the society they lived in. Now contrast that with the two over here. They walk back into a place where they were people of note, and people go back to their houses and carry on harvesting. Right? So the contrast should be...
When the town was in need, and so the town doesn't feel like...
Right, so that part of it is their reaction, is their policy seems to be either too busy, or now you left us, we're not going to necessarily... to deal with you, or it could be the Rus who's hanging on. Maybe she's part of the reason it didn't work out, and they step backwards. But that just their acceptance, their welcome, should be contrasted with the way in which they left, the impression they left, and what that's what's so strong about how resolute Rus remains, and the struggles that she has to go through, joining something which doesn't necessarily want to be joined in the way that she feels it. On a more positive note, you'll notice that it says that the last few psukim of the last pasuk of this perek says it was betchilas ketzir sorim. It was the beginning of the ketzir sorim, but the trop, which is actually not included in the actual booklets, but they include a comma to indicate that the way you read it is betchilas at the beginning, comma ketzir sorim, which indicates, and as the Mamlo Es points out, that in fact this is going to be the beginning of the changes of tide. It's been 10 years, a decade of famine, of no food. This is Betchilas. This is the beginning, a new beginning. And that little grain of hope is what's going to be turn the tide, not only just in terms of what's going to go on agriculturally, but also in terms of Rus's life, Naomi's life, as the tide changes, although very subtly. So with that, I think we're going to just hold here, because what I'd like to try to do... Yeah, Rachel.
Are
we going to
talk more about how she changes her name? And
oh, yes. Name? Meaning Rus or Naomi?
No.
Yeah, so what's interesting about this is Naomi actually says, call me bitter. And this is an interesting point. Thank you for mentioning it. Naomi says, call me bitter, don't call me Naomi. Right? But we never see her called that afterwards. Mm-hmm. Right? In the rest of the Megillah, she's never called Naomi. So is that just a hyperbole? Is she trying to exaggerate the feelings that she's feeling? Or maybe no. Maybe no. Here again the Mamlo Oz jumps in and says that maybe that the way Rus treated her mother-in-law, the degree of respect, the degree of comfort that Rus afforded her mother-in-law, actually it brought back that name Naomi to her life. Which is an interesting point, because it's her request isn't adhered to. That's a very important point. She asks not to be called Naomi, and the Megillah is calls her Naomi continually, or the rest of it. So there's a suggestion that might be, that's exactly what Ruth is supplanting over here. So that's that. What I wanted to cut off here, just because what we try to do next week is, as you can see, this is already a dark time, and certainly the way Naomi describes it, the words she uses are actually very parallel to Eov. A lot of the words that she uses, so we try to understand first on its own terms, as we did this week, but then in terms of Tanakh as a whole, next week, of the comparison to Eov.